Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Alexandra Fuller is an amazing writer, as we all know, or we wouldn't be here. And I just think her memoirs are exquisite. All of her books are just beautifully written. And she's, I think, one of the greatest storytellers there is. I love all her books. And this one, Leaving Before the Rains Come, is just beautifully written and a wonderful story. And I think it's really gutsy of her to share so much of her life with readers. And I just really appreciate her time and talent. So please, let's welcome Alexandra Fuller.
I'm going to talk very slowly till my daughter gets here. I do just first want to say thank you, Tattered Cover, for still being here. And the real importance, I think, that bookstores like this have, it is an umbilical tie to the intelligent life, and God knows there's little enough sign of it anymore. And thank you for bringing your children and your embryos and yourself and your mind and the whole of you to this place, that this is, in fact, community. And I think often when we speak of community, what we really mean is gated community. And bookstores, I think, offer one of the few last places where, you know, we take that parenthesis down. And we understand, if we go into a bookstore, for many of us, it is hallowed ground and sacred space. So thank you. And I am now going to tell an anecdote that has nothing to do with this, and I am slightly stalling for time, but also it's the favorite thing that ever happened to me. My other favorite bookstore is Powell's in Portland, and I feel like between the Tattered Cover and Powell's, they raised me. You know, they had me out when I had first written books, and now I'm, you know, middle-aged, and they're still, you know, prepared to welcome me. And, you know, now at Powell's, it's like a 17-year-old. She couldn't even pronounce my name, or, you know, the apostrophes on Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight confused her, and she just said, Don't Let the Dogs Out. And I was like, yay, you know, you can barely talk, you're that young, and I'm still here. And so I started to do my presentation, and I, you know, was yabbering away, and there were two African-American women on the edge of the presentation, and they looked first exceedingly baffled, and they had copies of my book, and then they started leafing through the book, and then one starts slapping her thigh, then they start slapping each other, then it's like this fight. Well, it turns out that they had misread the program, and a week later there was going to be a speaker about post-traumatic stress syndrome. The only other time this happened to me was in Cape Town, when I went to give a talk on Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, and the audience looked deeply understanding and then deeply baffled. And then eventually a woman came up to me and said, darling, if you don't mind me saying, you've got a long way to go. And it turns out that the bookstore had got the advertising wrong, and I was there instead of a woman who was talking about her 12 steps to recovery from alcoholism. This morning I was in Seattle, and the lovely driver who was taking me to the airport said, so what do you do? And I feel like, you know, the most unpopular answer you can give, like on an airplane or whatever, is I'm a memoirist. And so I said, you know, I write. And he said, what do you write? And I said, memoirs. And he looks in the mirror and he's like, are you that old? And I said, you know, I'm 46. And he said, how many of these things have you written? I said, four. And he said, you must be lead a fascinating life. I said, not really. I'm just incredibly self-involved. And the thing is in my defense, and that's true, I am very self-involved, but you know, we're all the center of our own universe. Like, that is a scientific fact. I made my biology teacher cry, and I almost failed physics and chemistry, but I know this is a scientific fact, that the center of the universe is you. Like, that's right? Are there scientists here? Can someone... Right? It's true. Except for somewhere in Idaho, some mayor got the wind of this, and so the mayor of this tiny town in Idaho made some street in some tiny town in Idaho, the center of the universe. But other than that, it's you, right? And so we're all that self-involved, and we're really judgmental about it. But the truth is, the only reason that we think everybody else is spending all their time thinking about themselves is because that's what we're doing, is spending our entire lives thinking about ourselves, mostly. I mean, unless you're like Gandhi or Mandela or something. And Hi, darling. what I realized, though, is that I really hadn't, you know, when I say I'd written memoirs, like, for one thing, I didn't really have a choice. So I was raised by a woman who was so, my mother, who was, well-ish. In other words, I came out of her biologically, but then she was a bit like a cow. She sort of dropped me and then moved away. And what I love to say about my mother is she is the most wonderful parent and has the most atrocious parenting skills. And in that, what she has done, and she is a wonderful parent for someone in her middle age, because what my mother has done, which I adore, is she messed up so profoundly, but she's forgiven herself and embodied herself. And I think if you can get to middle age and forgive yourself for the first 46 years, you're going to be a lot less violent and reactive going forward. And you may have a chance, actually, to go gently into that good night, which we need more of, instead of to go fighting and embattled and angry. So I had written books I didn't have a choice in this way. My mother was the most beautiful woman in Eastern Africa, incredibly glamorous, and recognized that in herself, and, you know, sort of considered that the Kenyan light was so beautiful mostly because she was in it. And so she had wanted to write a biography. She knew she was sort of biography worthy, something like Out of Africa or, you know, West with the Night. But she's too damn lazy to write her own book. So when she was pregnant with my older sister, she read my sister the entire works of Shakespeare in the womb in the hope that that would just magically produce a biographer. And the upshot was my sister was born and willfully and functionally illiterate, just refuses to read and write. And even her vocabulary, when my mother and my sister came to visit me here, and if you're not a U.S. citizen, I don't know how many of you know this, they give you a green card on the airplane that says, are you now, have you ever been a communist? Are you now, have you ever been a Nazi? Do you intend to blow up the country? You're a drug addict. Do you have some contagious disease? Do you have $1 million on you? Are you smuggling and, you know, blah. And my sister didn't bother to read it because she can't, won't. And she just wrote, yes, 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 yes. And so my mother said it was absolutely one. My mother loves men in uniform. So she said it was fantastic. We landed in Newark and they frog marched your sister off. And the border patrol had to waddle because he had a gun strapped to every appendage. And they dragged your sister back to a little room and it was just your sister and 1,000 weeping Mexicans. I do love this country. So my sister, aside from being willfully illiterate, she's also doesn't really bother too much with vocabulary. you know, she can get in the ballpark or maybe sort of rhyming slang region of what she wants to say, but she doesn't really bother to sort of nail it. So she, when my father announced that that's it, he's done, you know, his 3 score year and 10 and he's going to snuff it. And he was quite proud of himself. He said, I should be pretty flammable by now. Drunk plenty of brandy in my years. Easy to cremate, I would have thought. And so my sister said to me, this is appalling. Dad's, you know, planning to croak and mum's going to be so distressed. And, you know, her husband's so grumpy. We can't possibly have him speaking to these mourning people because he just will terrify them. She says, no, Bobo, when Dad dies, you're going to have to do the urology. So... having failed miserably with my sister as a potential biography, my mother fixed her not inconsiderable literary ambitions on me. I had no choice but to write. But what I realized is, you know, I wrote 9 unsuccessful novels, and they, you know, incredibly unsuccessful. They were so unsuccessful that I was rejected by every major publishing house, and then my agent fired me. And then my husband went to go and climb active volcanoes in Mexico for 6 weeks because that was more fun than living with a suicidal rejected writer. But when he left, you know, typical male, lots of drama, he put an envelope on his computer, on his sort of keyboard, that said only to be opened in the event of my death. So, you know, I did wait till he got to the bottom of the driveway. And then it was the most boring letter I've ever read in my life. You know, blah, 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 mortgage, yabba, 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 insurance, things that I had no possible way of understanding, and all turned out to be complete fiction anyway, as we all found out in 2008. But at the end of the letter, he said the only true thing, which is, why don't you write your story? And so I wrote my first memoir in 6 weeks, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. But my mother, who was very thrilled that I had written a book at all, because she kept saying, you know, I'm producing a writer and blah, 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 was horrible, that awful book, she said. And that's how I knew it was about her. And the reason I know this book is about me is I'm absolutely terrified to speak about it, which is why I've been standing here for 20 minutes and I still haven't said the first thing about it. Because it's one thing to stand up and throw your mother under the bus, and it's quite another thing to write about yourself. And it's very true that for a woman to speak about herself, Adrienne Rich says that when a woman tells her truth, it makes room for some other woman to tell her truth. But, you know, as far as I know, no woman has told the whole truth, in part because we are stitched to our biology. And if you have had children, then your first priority is to protect them. And you will never tell the whole truth. And your second priority is to protect the father of your children. And the truth, therefore, remains unsaid. And this book is not, therefore, what people say, a story of a marriage and a divorce. It couldn't be. It's a story of one woman's possession of herself. And really, every woman knows that marriage is not the most important thing that you do, and having children is not the most important thing you do. The most important thing you do is finally come to that place where you recognize, I am. I realized I was terrified to come on tour for this book. And part of that was because there was some early publicity, and the New York Times came out, was a journalist from the New York Times. And the problem with that, she followed me around for a whole day. And the problem with that is after about 10 minutes of it, like, I can hold it to get, my internal editor is going to be present for 10 minutes. And then she's on sabbatical. And so there is going to be a time eventually in which I say something that will pretty much offend everybody. And usually that's before breakfast. And now I've got to hold it together for a whole day. This isn't going to go well. But anyway, you know, my publicist says, you can't turn down, you know, being with the New York Times all day. So she shows up. And sure, and double problem, I'm turning into my mother, which is awesome in a lot of ways. When I sent my beautiful Sarah out there, and Sarah Sarah turned 18, I gave her Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, like handbook survival. I said, read this, and then I'm sending you to visit Granny. And Sarah came back, and she goes, my God, you underwrote that woman. So this woman comes out from the New York Times, and somewhere in the course of the day, the internal editor apparently left, and I said, you know, I have a feeling that, you know, for most women, by the time they get to middle age, they have a couple of choices. They can either behave badly or take Xanax. And the Xanax-taking crowd in Jackson Hole, which turned out to be all the women, went crazy. They were so offended. And, you know, the reason I said that was that I feel like we're really into bumper sticker feminism in this country. Like, well-behaved women really make history. No, wait. Badly, what is that? Okay, whatever. Because it's meaningless because it's on some bumper sticker of a Subaru, and you look inside the Subaru, and this poor woman has been up since 4 a.m. You can tell she looks frazzled. She's been making the lunches. She has tried to look sexy. She's, you know, whatever. She is. She has tried to do her. There's 3 screaming children in the back. She's going to her job, and you know she's going to be up to. I know her. I was her. I'm like, take the bumper sticker off and just say, you know what? I've checked out for 20 years, pretty much. That whole fallacy in this country that women can have it all, I think that's a vast patriarchal conspiracy. What they really meant was, you can do it all, and meantime, we're just going to put our feet up like we've always done and have the 3 martini lunch. And I just say, let's switch that over. I am taking the 3, I'm not even going to ask permission, just doing the 3 martini lunch. It is so awesome. I mean, the problem is I'm not having meetings before and after, so I can see how this could spiral down. And I just also feel like, you know, my mother was my earliest teacher, and she was impatient with mathematics because she thought writing was so much more glamorous. So she never taught me how to count. So I'm iffy about math. But the way I see it, men have been in charge for some years, like a few thousand, like, I don't know, what a thousand, I don't know, since at least Jesus, right? And, I, you know, with all due respect, you have screwed up. And so the way that I sort of think that we don't really have time, I think, to have a debate and a conversation, level of play. Just if you're a man and you're in a position of power, step down. Nearest woman, step in. They can't screw it up worse than you already have. And then we, or alternatively, women just take a nap. We're exhausted. And the world really would grind to a halt. There would be no water drawn, no firewood. The 1 in 10 little girls in Africa who are not getting an education and have no voice. That is where I am. So I was going to go on the road for this book, and it's hard speaking from here because although speaking about your childhood is easy, that's from a distance. Speaking about where you are now is incredibly difficult. You're up for everybody's judgment. And now I've got the Xanax-taking crew yelling and screaming that how dare I say this thing and that thing and blah and write a book and whatever. No one's read the thing. So my current partner said, I think you should take Xanax. And so I went to go and see my doctor, and she's like, yeah, fully. And you know what? It's so cute. They come. If you haven't tried it, you should. They even look like mummy's little helpers. They have pink pills. They're sweet little things. And I'm like, you know, like a Labrador retriever. You know how when you're trying to train a Labrador retriever, they only hear the last thing you said, like, don't jump up. They just hear jump up. You know, don't eat yourself to death. Just eat yourself to death. So I was like that with the pharmacy thing. It said, don't take with alcohol. I'm like, all right, big glass of wine, 1 Xanax. Well, I was so unanxious, I could have woken up single, divorced, pregnant with co-joined triplets and been just fine. And my partner did the sweetest thing a partner can do. I hadn't been sleeping. I was so, you know, horrified about what I was going to do. And he said, you know, I'm just going to watch you and keep you safe until you go to sleep. I was like, oh, that is so nice of you. Thank you. How will you know I'm asleep? And he said, you might stop talking. The The story of how a woman finds possession of herself is never easy. But for me, I was really fortunate in that I spent the first 11 years of my life believing myself to have inherited the universe. I was came to consciousness in Rhodesia as a white child. And so in Rhodesia as a white child, I was given the unearned privilege of an education, access to healthcare. My father could buy land. He was allowed to own land because of the 1923 Lands Appropriation Act. Yes, a war arose because if you consider yourself elite and if you announce yourself as an elite, there will be a challenge to that eventually. And so there was a very violent war, which is always, I think, the big danger of saying we're the big, most powerful, most influential people on earth. I'm hoping this is ringing bells and I don't need to rub it in. When I was 11, all of that changed, as it will for everyone in this country. I mean, that is the great, I mean, if we live long enough, but that is the great thing, isn't it? That everything circles around and comes around. And for me at 11, the country that I knew to be mine by my birthright, simply by the color of my skin, that was gone. Its name changed. It went from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe. And that thought experiment that I gave you, where all the men step down and the women step in, that actually happened. All the white people stepped down and black people stepped in. And I can't, I mean, the thing is that you can't know until that's happened to you what dispossession feels like. And I was really fortunate to have experienced dispossession and still remain white. Because in general, in the universe, if you're white, you still have privilege. It's unearned, but you still have it. And so you can be dispossessed of everything somewhere, and somebody else will take you in. I mean, when I became an immigrant to this country, people, I mean, they cry like, oh, you're an immigrant. That's, wait, you know what? Because I look till I open my mouth like the kind of immigrant you want me to be, you know, you want to have here. I was white of childbearing age. Yippee. Come on in. You know, and that is, I think, what is so hard about possession. To be dispossessed at such a young age and yet still have privilege, it takes a kind of flexibility of mind to know that when you've come to your new country, and I came through that other form of possession, which in our mind was marriage. So when I turned 18, my parents announced to me that I was not African. I belonged nowhere on the continent, not in Zimbabwe, not in Malawi, not in Zambia, none of the three countries in which I lived. And I had left my whole heart there. And that was a terrible thing to hear. That, yeah, you know, guess what? This place that you're violently in love with, that we fought to stay in, you don't belong here. You're English. And my feeling around that was, what horror. I mean, have you met the English? They haven't had an official emotion since 1776, for one thing. I mean, I couldn't just go and join them. You aren't your color. You're not your passport. But, you know, my parents have sort of raised me in this way, too, that, you know what, you're female. So what you will be doing for the rest of your life is be married. Somebody will have possession of you. And that's just it. And I think so much in the folklore and fairy story of our stories, yeah, that also happens to young women. You are invisible and unwanted until you're co-joined, until you become visible by male gaze. So what is it for women to get into their own bodies in any particular way? For me, it was my hunger. So my mother was so furious when I wrote my first memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. First of all, she was so proud. She told all her friends, come on, Bobo's written a book. This is wonderful. And then they all read the book and she said, oh God, isn't it awful? She said, you know, the problem is she's become an American. And what that means is, you know, over there, they like to write tell-all books about how they weren't hugged enough as children. And then they go on the Oprah Springer show. But the thing is that the real gift of becoming U.S. citizen was that when I was at my signing in ceremony in Kemmerer, Wyoming, and they got the dentist, I think that was like the most elevated person they could find to do the signing in ceremony. What he said to us was nobody leaves their mother or their motherland because they want to. And that, I think, is very hard for US-born people to understand. In this country, you believe, people are raised to believe, that you are living in the most exceptional country in the most exceptional time of almost exceptional universe, exceptional, exceptional people. Who the hell wouldn't want to live here? You know what? No one leaves their mother or their motherland. And somehow the dentist knew this. And he said, bring us your hunger. You came here because you were so hungry, you couldn't stay where you were. And keep your hunger, whatever it is. I mean, he was, of course, ignoring First Nations, on top of whom our hunger has become a kind of starvation. And he was ignoring those immigrants who were who were brought here against their will hundreds of years ago in order to fulfill our hunger, which is to say the African-American experience. But for us fresh immigrants, he said, bring us your hunger. And for me, it was my freedom to speak my mind. And of course, what we forget is that you can't, speech loses its power unless there's silence. And that speaking loses its power to heal unless we listen. And that we have become so noisy, we have lost the dignity of our intelligence. But that it's okay to have freedom of speech. But if you don't use it, you may as well not have it to begin with. When I first moved here, at some point I need to shut up. When I first moved here, when I met my now ex-husband, he said he was from the Philadelphia Main Line. And I thought, oh, thank God he's from a family of heroin addicts. And that turned out not to be true. And we go out to dinner parties and I'd sort of come limping back with bruised shins. And he'd say, just because you've got freedom of speech doesn't mean you have to use it 24 hours a day. And he was like, you're like the nouveau riche of freedom of speech. Those of us who've had it for a few generations are a bit more tasteful around it. But, I live in Wyoming, and what I noticed when I got here was a lot of people have taken the fifth, or a lot of people use self-censorship, and we are so censored by money that in this culture, really the message that we get is, we are just a black dot along somebody else's bottom line. And the message we get, particularly as women, is that you have I think what you don't realize is that as a U.S. citizen, you have a hunger too. And it's a hunger perpetuated by the myth that you're not enough. That because if you stopped consuming, the U.S. economy would crash. And so the message is loud and clear in order for you to keep consuming that you're not enough. You're not thin enough. You're not beautiful enough. You're not desirable enough. You don't dress enough in the right way. You don't have enough of the latest gadget. You're not connected enough. You're not in love enough. You're not enough. And what I deeply understood at some point, and I think that this is true of a lot of people, that we partner with someone in this culture in the belief that they should be everything to us. And so much of us end up in partnerships of isolated confinement. But what it takes to break out of that is a possession of one's voice. And that isn't an easy thing to earn, because so few of us are really speaking our minds. And we've become so used to the lies and the sort of commercialization of the lies. I propose that from now on, politicians shouldn't be allowed to speak, but their major sponsor should just stand up and say, hi, I'm here for Big Pharma and I support this person. So if you vote for that person, pharmaceuticals will be more available. Or hi, I'm here for Big Oil and the military. And so I support, that would be at least honest. Hi, I'm here for marijuana and free beer. I would so vote for that person. But think about the way, when my books come out, people accuse me or praise me for being brutally honest, and it makes me realize the rest of you are just lying through your teeth the rest of the time. Must be, right? I wrote my way into possession of my mind, in possession of my voice. And I am never going to give it up. Not for anything. Because it was such a slog. You know, being self-involved, you know, we think everyone's doing it. And they're not. Everyone's doing everything they can not to be self-involved. Everyone's driving, looking at a map, Google Map, iPod, iPad, texting, crocheting, whatever. We are doing everything we can, giving themselves a pedicure while they drive. Everything they can not to be present with themselves. To get present with yourself is a paring down to bedrock. And at bedrock, what you realize is you're not that interesting. No one's that interesting. I mean, having sat with myself over a period of time, what I've realized is I've been so in reaction, not just to my parents, but to my forefathers and foremothers, that every woman is in reaction to the education she has been given. And that every woman has one stopping point, and that is the point at which someone in their family, some woman in their family became financially independent. And for most of that, us, that's us or one generation ahead of us, or maybe it's our daughters. But when we own our checkbooks and our bodies, that's great, but first you have to possess your mind. And you cannot possess your mind with that loop going around and around telling you, you're not enough. I mean, you're enough. That's it. You showed up. It's enough. But it would be catastrophic for patriarchy, for power, for consumerism, if every single person in the country said, that's it. Showed up. I'm enough. There is a wonderful quote, Edwidge Danticat, she's a Haitian-American writer I've become slightly obsessed with. She says this, there's always a place where that if we listen close in the night, you will hear a mother telling a story. And at the end of the tale, she'll ask you this question, où libéré? Are you free, my daughter? By that, what I really mean is, are you in possession of your mind, my daughter? Because if you are, you're free. If somebody else is in possession of your mind, then you're not in possession of your voice or of your body. And it's scary to do it. You know, I love that quote from Kurt Vonnegut. He says, if you want to really hurt your parents and you don't have the nerve to be gay, at least become an artist. But I think what he really meant was at least become yourself. For most people, I don't know, I'm a woman, so I'm speaking from a woman's point of view, because it looks to me like men at least can, you know, travel west and go climb Everest and do whatever the hell they want to get in possession of themselves. Women have a very different journey. But for women, I really think what you're saying, I would like to say to Kurt Vonnegut, yeah, I think really if you want to terrify your parents, become yourself. And in this culture, what we say so much to our children is, you can be anyone, you can be anything. And then they come to you and say, I'm transgender. And you're like, well, okay, not that. Or, you know, I want to be a writer. And they go, well, okay, except for that. What our parents are telling us is you can be anything you want, meaning please be a doctor or a lawyer. But given if those two choices fail you, then no, I'm actually not in support of you being yourself. And the culture isn't supportive of you being yourself. And so for me, I mean, this whole book, 20 years, and I don't know how many pages. You don't have to read it now because I've told you. That this is that long journey through being in possession of so many other ideologies that all turned out to be false until I came down to the absolute bedrock of self. And the absolute bedrock of self, once you know yourself, it is the absolute peace of absolute self-knowledge. Because it turns out you cannot let yourself down. One of my favorite stories, and then I'll end, was I went to Robben Island to visit where Nelson Mandela had been incarcerated. And they tell the story of this tiny little prison cell where he was in isolation for decades, right? They said they had to keep changing the prison guards on Nelson Mandela's cell because the prison guards kept falling in love with him. That if you are authentic and so deeply in love with yourself that your love spills over to all humanity, then you will change the world, even if it's one person, just one person, and that person may be you. That's it. Thank you. Questions, comments, problems. Can I just confess something? I have given two speeches back to back tonight. So if I repeat myself, would someone just say we heard that already? Because otherwise I really will just completely have morphed into my mother. Okay, so I get this question a lot, like, how do you remember your childhood and, you know, how do you, like, you're a memoirist, so how do you so vividly remember anything? Well, I was hugely aided at a young age by having so many near-death experiences, and they tend to sharpen the mind tremendously. And, you know, having, I mean, when I wrote, I have broken so many taboos. So when I wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, it was the first taboo. You know, thou shalt be a good daughter. Don't you dare say what your family structure was like. And people would, I would go back to Zambia and people would say, you know, how could you do this? How could you write this book while your parents are still alive? I'm like, well, look at the woman. She's going to outlive all of us. And now with this book, you know, how dare you write this? What about your ex-husband and your children? Will you stop at nothing? And my answer is, I hope not. And that is my job. I'm a writer. And I think you're born that way. You know, just P.S., I bet no one asked Ernest Hemingway what his ex-wives thought of his books. Just saying. And... you know, I think that there is this way in which you're born a writer, you're born observant, you're born always feeling a little on the outside. And I did, even as a child. I mean, my very, very, very best friend from my earliest friend. So she's my, not this beautiful baby, my youngest baby's godmother is Zambian. And she's so glamorous and beautiful that when people meet her and so sort of urbane and sort of, I don't know. I mean, she just has it together in a way that I, like, if I spent the rest of my life at Pilates and at the pedicure manicure, I couldn't have it that together. And people go, how are you friends? And she says, you know, she was the only white person who would talk to me in the boarding school we were at. And so I, on some level, I've always been on the outside, more interested in the interesting people and in the culture that I'm swimming in. I think because my father never saw a convention he didn't want to kick down. Even though he fought to keep Rhodesia white run. You know, when I asked him about that, he said, well, I wasn't going to let some other guy get the bullet for me. I was white. I wanted to stay. My number was called. I went. He didn't believe in it, but he did it. So I think I was incredibly observant just always. And I was, you know, I think growing up the way I did, I lost three siblings. I lost so many friends. I mean, I would go back to boarding school and they would do roll call and there'd be kids who'd been killed on the weekend. And then when the war was over, we had our own sort of little truth and reconciliation. You know, I suddenly was in a black boarding school, having been among all whites. And so I'm talking to kids who had had a really violent war, much more violent than mine. I mean, have I already said that I am talking from a place of such privilege? Have I given you that sermon? Okay. Yeah, no, and I think that was where I really learned that these young people, I was 11, 12, these girls were my age, they had been and they had been raped, they had seen rape in a way that their war was even more personal and awful than mine had been. And they knew the men who had done it. They weren't that many white people in my community. They're like, yeah, we all know who your fathers are. I mean, that wakes you up. You are not, and I think the great trick of a comfortable society is that it is anesthesia. I mean, that's after all. It makes you less restless. You're not going to question. You're just going to happily keep turning the television on and consuming more stuff. And that's not the job of the writer. As Kafka said, the job of the writer is to take an axe to the frozen sea inside. I mean, if I was an anesthesiologist, that's a different thing. You can pay someone to put you to sleep. But it is the job of the writer to wake you up and to watch and to be observant, and most of all of him or herself, because I think it was very easy for us to get caught up in the own myth of ourselves and put ourselves to sleep. I mean, I hope if I've ever taught my children anything, and actually Sarah was the one who gave me this phrase, but it gave me vocabulary for what I had been trying to teach you, was never mistake your comfort for security. And I loved that. It changed everything. Get comfortable with your discomfort. Nothing important has ever been done comfortably. I mean, man, you know, I don't know. If going to the moon wasn't important, I don't know if it was. But anyway, that wasn't done because people got comfortable and were like, oh, well, screw it. I think I'll just roll off the sofa and go to the moon.
Can you say it again? Don't get comfortable. Say
that. Never mistake. What is it, babe? Yeah, don't mistake your comfort for your security. Questions? Oh, God, you look so beaten up. My nephew said that. He said, you know, my experience of having you as an aunt is you beat us up and then hug us. we just had Martin Luther King Day in the rest of the world. In Wyoming, we had Equality Day. Because if they accepted that it was Martin Luther King Day, I guess the people who are running the state would have to come to grips with the, I don't know, uncomfortable fact that there's other people other than white men. And so we have Equality Day, and that's because Wyoming labors under this myth that they're the equality state. And that's only because we gave women the vote in 1890, which, you know, yay. But that was also only because if we didn't give women the vote in Wyoming, we wouldn't have been a state because there weren't enough people. So I guess the guys looked around and they were like, oh, we want to be a state. What are we? Well, sheep women, huh? Well, I guess, oh, God, I guess women are people. And so they gave women the vote. And so they had this Equality Day. I'm just trying to make the men in this audience feel a little more comfortable with the fact that compared to being my son, you've got it easy. So they had this Equality Day march on the Elk Horn Antler, you know, Jackson, Wyoming, Equality Day march. And my son was going to be one of the keynote speakers. He's a white American male. And I was like, I am just too embarrassed by that whole thing. I, whatever, you're on your own. And so they marched, and to observe Equality Day. And then I start getting texts, and I'm bumping into people in the grocery store, and they go, your son, Fuller, gave such a brave speech. I went racing home. I said, what the hell did you say, Fuller? And he goes, well, you know, you've always told me, like, women in the state only earn 60 cents on the dollar to every man in Wyoming, and that in Wyoming is the third... In Wyoming, you're... Like, of all of you're the third most likely state in the nation to die at the hands of your spouse, of your partner, than you are anywhere else in the nation. And you're right on and on. And he goes, so I looked out at the audience, and you're right. Like, it was mostly white males, but there were some women, and there was no one of diversity. And so I brought up the gender, you know, income gap, and spoke about domestic violence. And I was like, Fuller, that was so brave of you. And he goes, I know, right? You know, I mean, and Dick Cheney's our neighbor, which is sweet because sometimes he and I come out with a memoir in the same year. But so my son goes, I know, right? So to be this like white, you know, all white hockey playing 17-year-old feminist in Wyoming, that's really scary. But it's a lot less scary than being your son. And he said, and then reminded me of a story, which... pretty sure he's making up, but it does kind of sound like something I might have said. So apparently when he was like 5, I said to him, now look, you came out of my vagina, just so you know, and unless you grow up to be a feminist, I'm going to shove you back in there. And that is one way to raise a feminist son in the state of Wyoming. One more question. Yes. Look, we other all the time, and we other to such a violent extent that we can't even see our own othering. Of course we can't. I mean, otherwise it would be so then we would be in a place of complete discomfort all the time, which I think would be awesome. Southern Africans stay there. One of the questions I get a lot is, why did your parents stay? What is implicit in that question is they're white, therefore they must have the choice to move. No one would ever say that if they were black. People don't say that of black U.S. citizens. You are being treated unequally where you are. People don't say that of Native Americans, but we say that of white people because we know deep down that white people have the privilege of the world, that you are an acceptable immigrant. You're not a boatload of Haitians arriving in Cuba being turned back. You're not an unwanted citizen of the world, and particularly if you're white male. And the one thing that I love about one of the questions that has I mean, my parents have us Zambian residents, which becoming a Zambian resident is infinitely more difficult than becoming a U.S. citizen. And my father's sort of response when I said I was becoming a U.S. citizen is, well, God, I hope they'll take you because no one else will have you. But, you know, if you ask my father, what is it like being a white man in Zambia? He'll say, I don't know. Go and ask a white man. Because in order to stay in a place, if you continue to other, you will be in such violent discomfort with yourself. And yet we do that all the time here.
I don't know what you mean. I'm sorry. The other thing.
The other thing. So when we say community, what we really mean is gated community. In other words, we are very comfortable voicing our anger and our anguish and our solidarity of everyone around us looks like we do. But otherwise we become so uncomfortable that, you know, in spite of having, I think, this incredible gift of freedom of speech in this country, we are terrified of the equal and opposite reaction of that, which is the courage to really hear one another, particularly when one another looks like very much the other. And so we see violence in Africa, coups in Africa, hardship in Africa. That's easy for us to see because that's over there. But if we have to bring it home, we get so uncomfortable we can't breathe and we don't want to hear about it. Okay, quick. Yes.
Can you read something from your book?
No, I've read it on tape. I can't. I honestly can't because it is so... thank you for asking. And I would so much, you've heard my voice, I would so much rather tell you why I wrote it than read it to you. Because this is the important and most urgent thing, was that you see my soul. If I put the book between me and you, that feels like cover. This was way harder, trust me. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.